There's a book by a guy named Don Norman. Don Norman is a cognitive scientist working in the field of design and usability engineering. And it used to be called The Psychology of Everyday Things. And Don Norman writes in the foreword of this book that he was very pleased with the title because it shortens out to be POET, right? Psychology, P, of Everyday Things, O-E-T. And academics really liked this book, but the problem is it didn't sell too well, so he ended up having to change the name of the book to Design of Everyday Things, so DOET. So unfortunately, he lost how cool POET was, but he upped the sales of his book. Anyway, so today's lecture and the next four are going to be on things that actually come out of that book, Design of Everyday Things or Psychology of Everyday Things, depending on how you like the name of the book. This is a book that you can actually go buy. I'd recommend it. It's a very light read. It's very fun. Don Norman writes in a very accessible sort of way. And today, and in the next four lectures, what I'll do is give you some of the highlights of DOET or POET in terms of concepts. So we'll just move on to the next slide. So to this point, you've seen a lot of interfaces. You've seen how they're designed poorly. We've talked about a number of ways that you can actually approach design such that you can hopefully design better interfaces. It turns out that the literature has a lot of really great words and concepts to describe the problems that we see. To this point, I think the only one that we've talked about is the difference between a slip and a mistake. And what we're going to do in the next four lectures is actually go through this list of vocabulary here. And it's a formalized vocabulary, which is what's useful about it. Because what you can do is when you have this vocabulary, you can talk about problems in interfaces with other designers and they'll know exactly what you mean. So today I think what we're going to do is get through perceived affordances through into mappings. So next slide. So by the end of today, you should be able to distinguish between a perceived and an actual affordance and to describe how visible constraints can help prevent errors in interfaces. You'll want to be able to discuss the role of mappings in interface intelligibility and to describe the ways in which causality plays a role in helping people understand how interfaces work. So next slide. So a perceived affordance is essentially properties of an object that suggest how one could actually use it, right? So chairs, if you just kind of look at what they look like, they actually suggest that you can sit on them, right? Tables also suggest that you can put things on them, and in sometimes they also suggest that you can place things on, or you can sit on them too. A knob, because of its kind of circular form, kind of indicates that it should be turned, right? Slots are for inserting, handles are for turning, buttons are for pressing, switches are for toggling. And with simple machines, you have these basic affordances that are actually things that we learn very early on, right? So my son is right now a year and a half, and he knows that light switches, based on kind of the shape and how they pop when you push one side rather than the other, it affords pressing. So if something looks popped out, he tries to press it, no matter what it is. So this is how simple machines work. What makes it challenging or interesting is to think about how perceived affordances work in relation to computers, because computers are, of course, you know, multi-purpose objects. And how do we think about affordances in this situation? Next slide. So in terms of product design, there are two things that we need to be concerned about. Perceived affordances, which are invitations for people to take possible actions, and actual affordances, which are actual actionable properties of the product, right? And so the problem is when these two things are not the same. That is that somebody perceives something, perceives a capability in your product, and actually it can't do it, right? So when people's perceptions are not what the designer expects, this is when we have a problem. So when we talk about perceived affordances, let's consider this in the case of an overhead projector, right? So some of the things that we think about are that mirrors are things that you don't touch, right? Handles are things that you're supposed to lift, knobs are things that you turn, and surfaces are for placing the transparencies. the problem with these affordances, if we hit to next slide, is that if the mirrors are not for touching, then people don't reposition the image, right? So in fact, this mirror is supposed to be moved. The question about the knobs is, does this knob actually focus or change focus the image, or does it change the image's position, right? If you actually use the handle here to lift the top of the transparency projector, you would actually bend the frame and you would distort the focus of the whole thing, right? The problem with the transparencies is which way is actually up, right? And then there are other things that are on these overhead projectors, so little knobs and stuff like this, and the question is, what do these things do, right? So you can see that although there is this notion of perceived affordances, the actual affordances that are provided by the system designer, right, there's sometimes a little bit of a mismatch. So if you hit the next slide, what we can talk about here is when there are issues with perceived affordances in graphical user interface design. Because mainly when it comes to affordances, the only way we can understand how a system works is how it looks. Designer essentially creates appropriate visual affordances via familiar idioms or things that I am familiar with seeing, right? Familiar ideas or metaphors, so that the thing here is something like something else, right? So if we hit the next slide, this is where some things pop up, right? So dials are for turning, sliders are for sliding, a music console is used to control the music. But then the question is, what are some of these other things, right? Are these things up here buttons, right? Is this an equalizer control, a toggle, or is it an actual button? Some things are actually buttons, but sometimes we don't know what they actually do, right? And are some of these things buttons over here? And in fact, they may actually just be things that somebody took off of an actual device and just copied the design. And the question is, are these things actually buttons? Because they look like they might be buttons. So again, you can see that there is this difference. And when there is these differences exist between what is perceived and what is an actual affordance, you end up with real issues. In the next slide, I'm just showing you something. This is called the IBM Real Phone. This is something that they developed in the early 2000s. And in fact, all sorts of problems came up with this thing too. So this was a cool little device that you, or a cool little app that you could use to make phone calls from your laptop, right? But all sorts of problems. What is that little knob where you flick it back and forth? So you can press it, but what does it do? Where are the visual affordances for actually doing window control on this thing? Is it something that I can minimize? Can I maximize this thing? How do I resize it? There are these places where I should be able to edit the text, but I can't. And for that matter, how does this actual phone work? Is this just a graphic or is it actual control? And so I'm going to show you a video of this system at work in class, and you'll see that there are all sorts of problems with this actual device. So a few more problems that come up in design, and this is a picture from a fairly old system, but these issues come up all the time. And so this is, again, for some rack, presumably, and these handles afford lifting, right? But in this case, they're actually used for scrolling for some weird reason, right? Complex things may need explaining, but simple things should not. And so I told you really early on that if you saw signs, if you saw labeling, that was often a case where, you know, what was existing there wasn't very clear, and so they needed to explain what would happen. And so the problem here, you see this tooltip, is that whatever it's doing, it's not good enough, and so they need a label. And if it's just doing a simple thing, then visually we should provide affordances that indicate what the system is actually going to be doing, right? So if you one of the concepts that comes up in terms of system design is you want to have very clear affordances of how to use the system. The system should actually guide you in terms of how it looks, in terms of the visual design, in terms of the layout, how to actually use the system. If it doesn't, it is not providing clear affordances. Next slide. Something that you can do to provide these affordances is to provide visible constraints. So where you limit the space of possible actions from an object's appearance. And you essentially limit the range of possibilities that can actually happen. So if you take a look at the next slide, here are some examples in real life of how you can constrain interaction through visuals, essentially, right? So a key is the same shape as the keyhole. That kind of shows you there's only kind of one way that you can insert this key. Right? There's a right way up and a wrong way up. And the way it's shaped kind of indicates this. If you think about extension cables, this limits the range of possibilities in terms of how things can be inserted, right? So you certainly used extension cables where there's kind of one fatter side and one thinner side. This is also constraining the space of possibilities. If you take a look at doors, which we've talked about in the past, kind of taking a look at how the handle is designed kind of constrains interaction, right? So if you take a look at your next slide, here's a butter knife. Which side should you actually use for cutting? There's no visual constraint that tells us how we should actually go about doing this. If you hit the next slide there, here's a quick example of how actually PowerPoint tries to provide visual constraints. So right now what's happened in this image is I've selected the image. And because it knows I've selected an image, what it does is it's actually grayed out all of the paragraph and font stuff that actually don't apply in this particular case, right? Because an image is selected, none of the font or paragraph functions are meaningful. So as a consequence, they gray it out. And that visually constrains how I'm going to interact with the system. It makes it clear that I can't do these operations, right? And so imagine that this wasn't the case. Imagine that they weren't grayed out. Let's suppose I pressed the Apple button, or the Apple image, and now I pressed, you know, like a bold. What should that operation actually do? Right? It's not really clear. And so by making it clear through these visual constraints, it simplifies kind of that user experience. In the next slide, so this is actually an animation. So if you hit play, you can see that, you know, it's just a stove to start, and then there is somebody puts a pan on there, and then somebody puts a washcloth on there, and then they turn on the thing, and then, oh, there's a fire, right? So, okay, this is obviously bad. So early on in stove design, as it turns out, in stove design history or lore, this used to happen a lot. And there used to be lots of fires with stoves, and people didn't like it and all this stuff. So if you hit the next slide, you'll see actually why. Early on, stoves had a lot of knobs, and the problem was... And let's just zoom in, right? So next slide. The problem was there were so many ways that these knobs could be interpreted. And this, these knobs and their relation to the hot plates or the actual elements, this is known as a mapping, right? So this is a familiar concept in computer science. So if you take a look at the next page, you'll actually see that there's this issue of what we call control-to-display compatibility. Right? So what is the natural relationship between controls and displays? And is there a clear visual mapping of stove controls to elements? And the reason why all these fires started was because there were so many knobs, and the mapping between the knobs themselves and the actual elements wasn't very clear. In this particular case, you could argue that having that extra knob on the right side for grill actually really confused things. You could say, okay, well, the icons are there, but the problem is there's just too many of them. And if you imagine using this thing and trying to use it without paying close attention, these things can happen. So there's a number of different ways that you can kind of rearrange this mapping to make it really, really clear. And on the bottom right of this image, you can actually see here are some arrangements that make it really clear which knob is for what. And obviously, you can come up with a bunch of other solutions. If you take a look at the next slide, here's an example of really great or reasonable control to display compatibility. A steering wheel, if you turn the steering wheel to the left, then the front tires turn to the left. And so, as a consequence, the car turns to the left. So this is a very good example of control to display compatibility. If you hit the next slide, this is something that's kind of interesting, I think, and it still continues to persist to this day. The mapping of scrolling in Apple products. So in 2011, trackpad scrolling behavior in OS X actually was reversed. So swiping fingers downwards would scroll upwards and vice versa. When they made this change, you can see, actually I did a quick Google, And you can actually see that people were very torn on this issue. So if you take a look at the next slide, the reason why Apple made this change was because iPhone use was becoming very, very popular at the time. And so on the iPhone, they had this model of touching something and pushing it around. And so Apple's idea was to obviously unify this model of interaction that arises from touch devices to their laptop operating system. And so just to recall, if we think about where this actually came from, this actually came from the Microsoft mouse, and where they were the first ones to actually put in a little scroll wheel in there. And the way that, they associated the scrolling or the detents on the scroll in relation to Windows was that it was scrolling a viewport around. So the model was that the mouse wheel scrolls up and down. So this was essentially using a trackpad model where your swipes are controlling the little scroll widget itself, that little scroll bar, rather than the content. And so this is interesting because when you change a mapping like this, people get very confused, unsurprisingly perhaps. So next slide, mapping and GUIs, palette controls and active objects, right? So only objects that can operate on a picture are fully visible. Others are completely grayed out. This is the selected picture. And so this is what you can actually do. So this relates again to that example of visual affordances, I think, and visual constraints. If you hit the next slide, here's another example of some mapping or ambiguous mapping problems in real life. So where in this situation would you plug the mouse? Or where which of these two serial ports is actually the A port and which one is the B port, right? So the mapping isn't perfectly clear. If you hit the next slide, another concept that's really important is causality. The thing that happens right after an action is assumed by people to be caused by that action, because this is how simple machines actually work. So if you think about a light, flicking the light actually, with a light switch, they actually turn off and turn on really quickly, right? But with things that have delayed action or delayed results, you end up with all sorts of false causality. Situations. So if you hit the next slide, two possible scenarios where you have false causality, an incorrect effect, so invoking an unfamiliar function just as the computer hangs, and this causes superstitious behaviors. So you're sort of attributing false causality here. An example of this is my dad installs a few new apps on his phone. And you actually have an old one that's hogging the resources. But what he does is he blames the slowness of his phone on there not being enough storage or memory or something like this, right? So he's incorrectly attributing cause to, or incorrectly attributing the effect to the wrong cause. An invisible effect is something where a command with no apparent result is often entered repeatedly. So a mouse click to raise a menu on an unresponsive system is a great example of this. In terms of causality problems, next slide. Here's an example of an interface where you have to press the exec button or the execute button to actually get the desired result. And so in this interface, you can actually change the RGB balance on the image, but you have to press exec before anything happens. If you just press OK, then it doesn't really work. Nothing happens. So this is obviously very confusing to somebody who's using the system. So these kinds of designs result in causality issues. So what I've done today is I've talked about four of these concepts from the design of everyday things: perceived affordances, visible constraints, causality, and mapping. Thanks very much.